We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
This episode of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, is brought to you by NHTSA. NHTSA is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And as we get into the holidays and New Year's Eve, it's important to talk about safety and driving drunk. Now, we all know the risks of driving drunk. There could be a crash. People could get hurt or killed. You could get arrested, incur huge legal expenses, and possibly even lose your job. You know the consequences of driving drunk, and you know that they are wrong, even though you said it was no big deal. Too drunk to drive means too drunk for complicated apps. So, NHTSA is sponsoring something called Safer Ride, and it is the simplest possible way to get home safe and only has three self-explanatory buttons on the home screen. You can call a friend, locate and call a cab company, or bring up a map of your current location. So let's help NHTSA end drunk driving by doing our part to use the Safer Ride app and get home safely.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds. To boldly go where no one has gone before.
Engage. Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
This is Captain Jonathan Archer.
Special Miss Burnham.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And to make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Sailing frequencies open, sir.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. This is a big day here at Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. We're in a new studio. Oh, whoops. So new, I'm dropping stuff. We're in a new studio, a makeshift studio. This is like, we used to have the Battle Bridge, right, Brian?
Yeah,
this is like,
so this is...
What could you call it? Like emergency bunker. What is the Star Trek equivalent of... Of Hoth.
An escape pod?
Escape pod. A runabout. We're in a runabout.
Sure.
We're in a runabout. We're in a shuttlecraft. For 1 week and 1 week only, Star Trek, Engage the Official Star Trek Podcast, has moved downtown.
We're downtown.
We're very hip now. We're downtown. I'm wearing a beret, and I'm smoking a rolled clove cigarette, because we're downtown hipsters. And we've moved downtown, but everything's in boxes. Listeners, all of my sound effects are in boxes this week.
Actually, you know what the saddest thing is so far is I packed up all our props for when we had our first episode. We had the video, and we had all the stuff in the background.
Yeah.
I packed all that stuff up. So far, the bat'leth is not to be found.
We lost the bat'leth.
I can't find it right now.
Brian,
so.
You've brought dishonor upon this house.
I have shamed this podcast.
You have been...
The movers have shamed this podcast.
Yes.
I packed it up very nicely.
It's terrible. Well, one thing I'm proud to see, Brian, is that you did bring your favorite green plaid shirt.
Yes.
All right, so we got a lot to talk about here on Engage Official Star Trek Podcast. First downtown episode and second to last of the year. We have a special guest with us today. Karen Hahn is here. Hello, Karen.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Karen Hahn is a writer for The Daily Beast, and you can also find her work on Vice and Vulture and Slash Film.
That's correct.
And she is a tremendous fan of Star Trek Discovery, so we know she's a good person. And where are you in Star Trek in general? Like, how are you? Have you voraciously watched all of it? I mean, you're a relatively young person, so none of this was on the... I would imagine that by the time, Deep Space Nine had ended, you were still but a wee less. So have you gone back and watched all of it, or are you kind of new to Discovery?
I'm pretty new. I feel like a lot of what I'm going to say on this podcast is going to sound end up being kind of like heretical just because of my lack of deep Star Trek knowledge.
No, let's rephrase that as a refreshing perspective.
Okay, okay.
That's the proper way to phrase it, a refreshing perspective.
But yeah, I didn't watch that much of anything while I was growing up, so I'm definitely behind on my Star Trek lore. I've started kind of going back through older episodes after like the first J.J. Abrams movie came out.
Right, yeah.
Because that was like the first, I think, big like zeitgeisty thing to put Star Trek back into the
right
pop cultural matrix.
You said, oh, this thing I've heard about my whole life.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, you know, you hear about Lord of the Rings and then you see the movie in 2001. You go, oh, I should probably read those old books.
Yeah,
you know?
So, 100%.
Well, cool. Well, you know, it's funny then because there are the topic of today's episode is going to be David Mack's book, Desperate Hours, which is the first Star Trek Discovery novel, and it's a prequel novel. And interestingly enough, David Mack, who's been a guest on this show thrice, I want to say, it seems like thrice, he held back on the in-jokes. He held back on the Easter eggs. There are a few, and the ones that are there are pretty outstanding. One in particular, and Scott Kalara of IGN, if you're listening, I was reading at my kitchen table, and I read something, and I almost texted you, and then I realized it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. So I said, don't do that, because his wife will get angry. But there is Scott Kalara, your favorite character, well, maybe your second favorite character in all of Trek lore is in this book on page 302. We'll get to that later. So but David Mack kind of held back. So again, part of the mandate of if you're a hardcore fan and you know everything, Discovery is for you. But if you are, and don't take this personal, Karen,
not
but
even
if you are, if you are a noob, if you wear the Scarlet N, and you are a noob, it's okay because this is for you too.
Thank you.
But you're not a noob. You watched the whole season obsessively.
It's incredible. I love it so much.
Yeah, you're in love with Saru.
I think everyone is. I don't want to speak for everybody, but
you were there at that party, right?
Yes, I was.
All right, let's back it up. Brian, we got to tell you what happened.
Sure.
So that's Karen Hunt. She's going to be our guest today, and we're going to talk about the book, and we have to tell a quick story about Saru. But before we do, there's one other news item, Brian. Last week, we talked over the phone about the rumor about Quentin Tarantino.
Yes, we did.
And we spoke 12 hours after the news item broke. And the crux of what I said was, this is just a rumor. This is not going to happen. It's fun to think about. But let's all calm down. And I do still think, by and large, the chances of a Quentin Tarantino Star Trek film at a theater near you is very, very slight. And, you know, listen to last week's episode, because I went into the politics of why Paramount would do this, why J.J. Abrams would let the story break, and Quentin and blah, blah, blah. But the one thing that did happen between last week and this week was interesting, was some intrepid reporter spoke to Patrick Stewart, and he was in, like, Qatar or the United Arab Emirates or something like that. He was accepting an award.
I know what you're going to say, but I didn't know that's where he was.
No, he was in the Middle East somewhere accepting an award at the blah 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 film festival, the Abu Dhabi Film Festival or something like that. I guess for Logan. All right. I mean, they couldn't get anybody else, I guess. So they got Patrick Stewart.
Still pretty good.
No, he's great. I know, but is he the guy you give an award to this? I mean, of course you give it to Patrick Stewart. So Patrick Stewart was getting an award, and some intrepid reporter said, "Hey, have you seen Variety, Quentin's doing a Trek movie. Would you want to play Patrick Stewart? Would you want to play Captain Picard again?" And Stewart has been pretty, you know, the last few years, he's been like, it's done. You know, because whenever any of these guys get approached, and the standard line is like, I love the character, right, if they ever want to call me. Because most of the people they're asking don't do that much work. I mean, when you're asking Counselor Troy, do you want to play Counselor Troy again? What is she going to do? She's going to say yes, you know? Of course she does. So, no diss to Counselor Troy. But, you know, Patrick Stewart's always been like, you know, I do appear at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in the part of King Lear, you know, fairly regularly. And I'm in Logan. And, you know, maybe it's time to hang up my space boots. But he was like, Quentin Tarantino directing Trek? Shit, yeah. That's not a direct quote. But it's pretty much what he said. And, you know, it's those little small, you know, stories that sort of propel. It starts to become a self-fulfilling prophecy when enough of those things happen. And what's interesting is, you know, I had just assumed Quentin, all we knew is that Quentin Tarantino said, "I have an idea." You know, he woke up one morning and he's brushing his teeth, scrambling his eggs. "I have an idea for a movie." And we just assumed that it was going to be an original series. But maybe it's not enough. Maybe it's Next Generation. Or maybe it is original series, but he will figure out a way to get Patrick Stewart in there because he could. I mean, the thing that excites me about this probably never going to happen Tarantino film is to treat it like in comics what you would call a one-shot. You know, like it doesn't necessarily have to be connected to the rest of the continuity. It doesn't have to play by the same rules. It doesn't have to have the same tone. You know, give it a try. And if you don't like it, then forget it, you know? Because nothing else going on with Star Trek movies right now anyhow. And then the other thing...
Well, didn't they also say it was going to be... that Tarantino said it would be an R?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that wasn't made available when we talked about it last.
Right. Which I find...
Interesting.
I find, like... you know, write the movie first and then find out what... Like, don't go in... Yeah. Like, I would say to him, do what you want to do and then let the MPAA figure it out. Like, don't go in swinging, like... I declare this shall be rated R. Like, that just seems a little childish to me.
It seems to be happening a lot, though, with kind of big properties where they're like, to make sure that it appeals to a quote-unquote adult audience, we're going to come out the gate swinging and say, it's going to be an R, it's going to be dark and gritty, and that's why you're
going to
like it.
Well, I mean, I feel like people, when you hear Tarantino, I feel like people expect an R. You know, they expect some...
Right.
Some level of...
Are any of his movies not R?
I doubt
I don't
it.
Think so, right?
And how could they? They're all very violent.
I can't
violent.
Think of any that wouldn't.
Yeah.
Like, the least violent of his movies, I guess, is Jackie Brown. That's got F-bombs all over the place.
Yeah.
And a lot of sex. Bridget Fonda in a bikini. So, I mean, look, I'm not even the biggest Tarantino fan. You know, I think he's, sure, Reservoir Dogs was, a revelation at the time, and Pulp Fiction was very, very cool. But, I don't know. Kill Bill Part 2 is really not that good.
Aww.
It's really not. Kill Bill Part 1 is fine, but eventually it's stop hurting each other.
These are very hot takes.
No, I remember I saw Kill Bill Part 1, who needs to see that many people get attacked with a sword?
Me 1,000%.
Yeah,
it just goes on and on and on.
The second one was a little bit more disappointing, but I did really enjoy that first one.
I did love, strangely enough, Death Proof. And I like Inglourious Basterds. And the things that I like about those two movies is I like the scenes... The really long dialogue scenes I find to be really, really engaging.
Inglourious Basterds has a lot of that.
Oh my god, the scene in the bar when he's upstairs and downstairs and "You're not going to shoot me." "No, I'm not going to shoot you. You promise?" "I promise." Comes down and shoots him. So here's the thing, and let's back it up. So one of the things we talked about last week, and it's been floated, is that Tarantino said, "Look, wouldn't it be cool?" He gave this in an interview on a podcast maybe 2 years ago. If we took one of the classic episodes and redid it. So imagine if you did City on the Edge of Forever. Just picture this in your head. City on the Edge of Forever with Chris Pine and Zach Quino and Carl Urban. I mean, those would be the three. It also gets rid of the Zoe Saldana problem because Uhura's barely in that episode. And because she's too busy. She's in Avatar 6 times. She has no time to do these movies. So... If you had City on the Edge of Forever, but with long dialogue scenes with those actors, because they're really, really good, those three. You know, they're really great. And then you get somebody to play Edith Keeler. It could be anybody, you know. That would be kind of amazing. R-rated? Who knows? But it's all very, very unlikely. But it's just funny that it's a news story that I thought would die. And there was like you said, there was the R-rated thing, which that one kind of struck me as
Well, I mean, I feel like people would ask that oh, hey, it's Star Trek. They've never done something like this before. You know, are you going to dumb down your normal movies, your tone of your normal movies because it's a huge IP?
Right.
And he's like, no.
Do it my way.
It'll be my way, whatever.
If you're going to hire Tarantino, let him make his movie. I mean, that's the thing. You're bending Star Trek, the brand. As I hold this licensed novel for hardcore fans, does have a certain bubble that it plays in, a certain sandbox that it plays in. You know, you don't have that much sex and violence in it. You know, it has to be, Star Trek is not for kids, but it is. You know, but it is. Kids can watch it. You know, there's the sort of the more cerebral 11-year-old that will watch. Deep Space Nine. You know?
I will say that every time when I watched Discovery, that my son was still awake, he would come across some like Klingon scene where there was some like violence. And and he would want, I would pause it or stop it, and he'd just want to know, and he'd be like pointing at the TV, and I'm like, no, you shouldn't watch this.
No, that is a tardigrade, ripping the spine out of somebody.
I was going to say, like, Discovery does kind of go, like, a little more in that
absolutely.
Direction.
Yeah, it's certainly, well, it's, and it had the famous F-bomb, and it has more violence than ever before. Mm-hmm. Of what's shown. I mean, it's still, like, there are a lot of mangled bodies in Discovery that you've never seen, and... you know, it has the gay romance, which rankles some ultra-conservative viewers for God knows what reason. So it is pushing the envelope. So anyway, I mean, what do you think? Do you like Tarantino Star Trek? Are you like some? When the news broke, some people were just like, "You gotta be freaking kidding me!" Were you?
I was pretty ambivalent about it, just in so much as like that's not a combination I'd ever consider.
No,
there's no universe in which you could be like, here's a Star Trek movie and Quentin Tarantino directed it that I wouldn't want to go see it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, any sort of major auteur with their own personal stamp, you know? Why not? I mean, there are some people who feel very possessive of a franchise, and I certainly understand that because I host the Star Trek podcast. So you don't want other people bringing their baggage to your thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like you kind of have to, and this is just philosophy in life in general. It's like if you love something, set it free, you know?
Aww.
Like, I mean, if Martin Scorsese, if Hong Sang-soo, if any major... you know, if Jim Jarmusch, if anybody wanted to do Star Trek...
Bong Joon-ho Star Trek would rule, I think.
You know, actually, that would make a lot of sense, frankly.
Yeah, he loves that weird stuff.
He does, and the creatures, certainly. Mm-hmm. I mean, he wouldn't even be a weird guy to do it. He would make sense.
Yeah.
Like, that would be a good guy to do it. So, you know, like, give it a shot. Like, it doesn't... I guess the thing is, and I do struggle with it, like... People who don't like remakes or sequels, they feel like you have this perfect thing. You have your thing. And then a remake comes and it doesn't ruin the original. On paper, it shouldn't. Like people who don't like the Ghostbusters remake with Melissa McCarthy. And they're like, well, the original was my thing. And it's like, well, you know what?
Yeah, it doesn't make it so that the original thing didn't exist. So
I know.
It's pretty
chill. I mean, I sort of understand like you're like, oh, all right, they got to. Or like a cover of a song you love that suddenly stinks, and like it's like some artist you don't like doing it. It's like, well, you know what it is? It's just part of getting older.
Oh no! The part with the songs is what when a kid comes up to you and says, "Oh, they love that song, but it's not by the artist that you know. It's about the new artist, and they have no idea."
Yeah. Well, I remember that because I'm older than all you. I remember when Mick Jagger and David Bowie had a big hit with Dancing in the Streets.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I mean, I was very, very young. It was the first time I heard it. And I was watching it on MTV, as I did back then. And my mother was like, what the hell is this? This is a song from my era. And I'm like, no, it's Mick Jagger and David Bowie. She got all upset at me. And then she was like, nobody can do anything original anymore.
Wow.
You know?
In today's moviescape, that's a pretty...
Yeah. Well, anyhow, that's what time it is with Quentin Tarantino's potential thing. And you know what else about what time it is, Brian?
What, I don't know. What time is it?
The time is, if you had a watch, you would know. You would not have to look at your phone.
Yeah, I'm looking at my phone.
Well, you're waiting for that email.
I'm waiting for that email.
Did Seth get back to you?
I did. I sent them both to you.
Oh, they're there.
I sent you emails.
All right, great.
Yes.
Thanks. There's the old expression, what time it is. Remember Flava Flav? He would wear a giant clock around his neck.
He did.
We should bring that back.
I should. No, what I'm not bringing back, I'm helping propel, is the great watches at Movement Watches. And Movement Watches, MVMT for short, is the sponsor of this show. And this is a very slick and nice way to know what time it is. Imagine... I'm not wearing my movement watch today. But
I was going to say, I don't think that's what they look like.
No, I don't bring it out all the time. I bring it out when I want to impress. No offense.
Oh,
I
mean, okay.
Nothing. You know, when I the movement watch. But the thing is, you don't have to save your movement watch because it only costs like $95. You can get a movement watch for $95 and they look like hundreds and hundreds in a department store. And movement watches, as you well know, were founded by two guys. They were out of college. Their names were Joe Move and Philip Ment. And Joe Move and Philip Ment started designing these very sleek watches that were affordable to young Schmendricks like themselves. And they, you know, they look very impressive, and you know, they certainly tell the time well, which is nice. And you know, it's kind of a new thing. Like, you know, you go out with your buddies and you want to impress, and they go, oh, we got to get there by 11:30. What time is it now? Everybody starts digging in their pocket, trying to get their phone out. You know, it's embarrassing. It's a better move to just look at your wrist and say, be there by 11:30. We got to leave in 5 minutes. You know, then you're the cool guy. So the way that you too can be the cool guy is to go to mvmt.com/engage. Brian, we have a special deal. You get
15% off with free shipping and free returns.
15% off. You're getting three special things, but you're only going to use two of them. You're going to get 15% off, which you're going to want. Free shipping, you're going to want that.
Mm-hmm.
Free returns, not a factor. Not a factor. Who's going to return their movement watch?
I wouldn't.
No. Only the shysters at the heart of, what was the name of the planet?
Saris 3.
Yes, Saris 3. If you were one of the shady contractors on Saris 3.
The Colvis Mining Corporation? Or
those guys are scumbags.
Yeah.
They would send back their movement watch because they're looking like a fix or something. So that's what's going on. Check out Movement Watches.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today. Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Star Trek Podcast.
Energize. So it's mid-season here on Discovery, which is, you know, what do you do when you need your Discovery fix? 2 days after Discovery premiered on CBS, regular CBS, the book came out. But I didn't read it until recently, and I'm kind of glad I waited. Because this is a really great thing to have during the off time. It gives you the fix you're needing.
It's a good holdover.
A great holdover, and it does a lot of contextualizing of some of the characters we've grown to love. Now, Desperate Hours by David Mack. And David Mack, as you know, he's a novelist of all sorts of things. He's written his own work as well as other sort of franchise fiction, but he's written a boatload. And he's also written some Star Trek episodes, one for he had the story credit on DS9, and one, was it Starship Mine? Was that his? I think it was, on TNG. No, it wasn't Starship Mine. He had two. I don't remember what they were, but he's written two, and they're great. He's written a lot of Star Trek books. So it makes sense that he would be the guy to do this one. And what's interesting is that this is a prequel novel. So it's set 1 year before the Battle of the Binary Stars. So what that means is a lot of the characters from Discovery are actually not in this.
Yeah, it's really just like three characters that we get to look at that are in the series, right? Or four, I guess. But
counting Detmer, yeah. Which is funny because... you don't get to know Detmer much in Discovery, and even in the book, she gets like one line. That's kind of like the running gag is like, bridge officers? Nah, they don't matter. So like, yeah, no Lorca, mm-hmm. no Stamets, no Culber, no...
no Ash.
Well, no Vok either, for that matter. So none of those guys. But this is a story set on the Shenzhou. And you're going to get a lot of Captain Georgiou, a lot of Saru, and a lot of Michael Burnham, and also a lot of Spock,
mm-hmm.
a little bit of Sarek,
mm-hmm.
a little bit of Amanda, and some new characters as well. Oh, and a whole lot of Captain Pike.
Yes.
And a whole lot of number one, a.k.a. Una.
Which I was very confused about at first.
Right, yeah. Well, we discovered her name. That was sort of a deep cut. That was, she's number one. I mean, but they call her Una a lot. We only learned that her name was Una in some other recent books. The Legacies trilogy from 2016.
Oh, huh.
Which David Mack was part of. She'd always just been number one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, from the cage. And it's great because she and Saru start flirting in this. Well, are they flirting or does Saru just have the hots for her?
Yeah, they're a little flirty.
He's got a little infatuation with her.
Yeah, which is awesome.
Little crush. Yeah, yeah.
That's
definitely.
The best. Yeah.
I enjoyed that.
Number one, of course, is Majel Barrett, who then she played number one in The Cage. And then she was Nurse Chapel in the original series. And then Loxana Troi from Next Generation. And then, of course, the voice of the computer for a whole lot of time. So that was pretty cool seeing her. So yeah, there's a lot to talk about here. First of all, it's a fun read, right?
Yeah.
Once you sit down to read it, you kind of blaze through it, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Right, because I saw you 12 hours ago.
Yes, that's correct.
And I'm like, have you read the book yet? Because we're doing the podcast tomorrow. And you're like, oh, I'm on like page 80.
Stop.
And the book is like 360 pages.
That was me yesterday too. A Sunday morning, I was about 90 pages in, and I finished it last night at about 11:30.
Yeah, so like once you find the time,
great.
It's a pretty brisk read. And this is not a knock on Mr. Mack's writing.
No.
This is exactly what it's supposed to be. It's brisk.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, I mean, it's thoughtful, but it's not like hard work. You know, it is a pleasant read, you know, if you're on a train, if you're...
That is where I did most of my reading.
Nice. Okay, there you go. So you blaze through it, and Brian, you blaze through it also. I guess what I wanted to mention at first was that... it is set 1 year before, mm-hmm. and David Mack did say that the basic premise was handed to him
by Brian Fuller,
who said, look, let's get a little backstory about Burnham and Saru and Georgiou. And it does answer a lot of questions about the relationships and also does a pretty good job of addressing some of those annoying questions that some fans have had about, like, why does their uniforms look different?
Yeah.
And they basically say... they're just saying just because they do. Like, they're different ships, and they were made at different times. Like, there was a part where the medical teams beamed down together.
Yeah.
And he described it as, like, you know, Dr. Boyce, who was, you know, from the cage, you know, Boyce is a character. Dr. Boyce's team had their gray tunics, and then the crisp white team was like, okay.
Where it's literally, it's like, they just got their uniforms made more recently, so that's what they look like now, and that's about it.
There's also a thing in the transporter room when they're like, oh, your transporter room looks different from ours.
Yeah,
they're like, your corridors are a different color. So it's like, you know, don't try to hide it, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's also it makes you realize how much of that debate was meaningless. Like, you know, like people are like, this shatters the reality.
Where you can just kind of say, it's like, no, that's just how it is.
Yeah, exactly. So what was your favorite part, Karen? What was pick one favorite of the many storylines? And we could do a little thumbnail of all the storylines. What was your favorite storyline?
We've definitely spoken about this already, but all the, like, Saru stuff was definitely my favorite. As soon as I figured out that he was going to get his own, like, character POV chapters, I was... delighted. And even more so when the storyline with Una started, like, coming up. I remember I was talking to a friend when Discovery started airing, and she was like, if this was Mass Effect 1000%, I would choose the option to date the alien. And I was like, that's exactly how I feel about this show. So the fact that that, like, kind of got, like, a little flirty was very cute.
Well, it's, you know, the Saru stuff is good because one thing that has been, I don't want to say bugging me, but I am curious about is, like, Saru is a bit of a fraidy cat, you know?
Yeah.
He's nervous. So part of me is like, why do they keep this guy around? Why is he such a high-ranking officer? And this shows him doing his stuff.
Yeah, like, he does good work.
He does good work. He's very smart. He's a very capable. He's sort of like even though he's not an engineer, he kind of fills the Geordi LaForge role. He's like a very capable, science-minded guy. But also, it talks about his backstory, which I don't think has been discussed on the show at all. Like, he is the only Kelpian in Starfleet.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as I was reading. I was like, I don't think we know that much about his species besides the whole, like, threat instinct thing.
No, we really don't. And so a lot of, there is some backstory about the planet Kelpia in here and the Apex species and the lives they've lived. And also, it talks about how Starfleet rescued him.
Yeah. I hope they do a flashback so badly in the back half of the season.
Yeah. Because it reminded me a little bit of how, like, Starfleet kind of found Data and, like, took him under their wing. Because Saru does refer to himself a lot. He talks about his Kelpian instincts and the struggles he has as a Kelpian, and it kind of makes him a little, I guess, neuroatypical or whatever you want to say. But he also refers to himself as the way we do it in Starfleet.
Yeah.
You know, he's very proud of his new adoptive philosophies and lifestyles, and that whole thread really, I thought, was really cool.
I really loved it, and it also serves kind of as a further way to parallel his story with Michael Burnham's, because she's also doing the kind of like whole dual cultures thing,
yeah,
which I don't think is as obvious in Discovery, just because we don't have as much like inter-narration on the
show. Right, 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 yeah. So the basic premise is this. It's a year before Battle of Discovery, Battle of the Two Stars. You know, Shenzhou's zooming around doing what they do, and there is a colony that has an incident, and the Shenzhou has to come to the rescue, and then there is, it elevates, so the Enterprise has to come to the rescue to help out, and then there's like a lot of interplay between these three things, and then there is an away mission in which Saru and Una, or Number One, go off to like look at cave paintings, which is very nice.
But that's more nice, so much date. More chill.
Yeah, but more excitingly, Burnham and her baby brother, to a degree, although they didn't really live together that much, Spock go, and they get caught in you know, Resident Evil or Saw, or there's a
Saw's a pretty good analogy.
They get stuck
in
Saw. They get stuck. Also, there is an Alistair Reynolds novella. Deep Heart, and I should ask David Mack if he's read it. I don't know. But there, I wrote it down because I read this 10 years ago. Alistair Reynolds, who wrote Revolution Space and a lot of great hardcore, hard SF, diamond hard SF. he wrote a book called Diamond Dogs. And it's about a, it's similar in that they go to a thing. They go to like a haunted house, basically. And there's traps. And it's puzzles. So Spock and Burnham have to solve puzzles to save the world, and it's awesome. It's just so free, and there's like one thing that really did feel like Resident Evil. There's like an axe floating.
Yeah,
as
soon as I read the description, though, it was like, there's a bunch of saws just swinging around everywhere. I was like, okay,
it's kind of ridiculous. And then the other relationship, really, although they don't go together, they sit in their own captain's chairs, is Pike and Georgiou.
Yeah.
And they butt heads. It gets pretty serious because the colony there's a mining colony, and they've been doing it all wrong. They didn't fill out the paperwork, basically.
Yeah.
And they're kind of an immoral mining colony. They are not part of the Federation. Mm-hmm. They've sort of divested themselves from the Federation, but they need Federation help because in their offshore drilling, they have uncovered what at first I thought was going to be Godzilla. Right, but then it turned out to be like an ancient spacecraft, and it sort of becomes, you know, fairly typical Star Trek episode. Like, there's a thing from an ancient culture. How do we tell it to stop trying to kill us? And that's basically it. But, and this was really interesting, and Brian, I'm curious to see what you think about this. Captain Pike comes to town with the express order from the Admiral that, like, you've got to kill this. They call it the Juggernaut, is the spaceship. This ancient, maybe alive spaceship, they don't really know, that's sending out drones and killing people. You have to destroy the Juggernaut, and the only way to do it, because they can't, for whatever reason, they can't tractor beam it out past the gravity well, so it's, they can
said it was too smooth or something like that.
There's some of the ablative plating or something like that. So they had to fire photon torpedoes of it at it on the surface of the planet, and by doing so, they would kill the population. And Pike is like, dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. And Georgiou was like,
nope.
What the hell?
Not going to happen.
Yeah. So were you surprised by Pike's willingness to follow orders that easily?
I think he was still conflicted. It wasn't as like, oh, he's like, I got to do this. I guess they told me to. I should do it. I mean, he was like, I don't like it either, but I have to, you know. So and I think he liked that the Admiral, you know, said like, hey, we need you to go there because we don't think this person will do it. But, you know,
they don't trust Georgiou. They think
to carry it out. So, I mean, it could be a like a power push on his part. You know, it's like, hey, the Admiral wants me to do this.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point, because Georgiou is superior to Pike.
Correct.
Pike is an inf- which doesn't really quite jibe with that episode of Discovery when Saru was like, show me the finest captains in Starfleet. Yeah. And they mentioned Georgiou, but they also mentioned Pike. I was like, all right, fair enough.
Just a little retconning. It's okay.
Yeah, a little retconning. But what's funny is Burnham, Georgiou and Pike are about to have a space battle in the orbit of this planet where these like gross miners, and they're all like, the miners are like prevaricating and hiding information.
They all kind of suck.
Being jerks, yeah. Yep. But they still want to save their lives. Like, you know, even though these people are jerks, we don't want to kill them and also destroy this ancient, we now know there's an ancient artifact from an alien culture. That's like not very Starfleet to blow it up. You want to study it. What would Picard say? So while they're about to go to war, and Burnham does a little something interesting, which is once again she kind of goes behind Giorgio's back, as she'll do at the Battle of Binary Stars.
And literally on day one of being the first officer.
Right. Yeah, she just got promoted. But she goes behind the captain's back, but does like a reverse Vulcan hello from the show. Like, whereas in the other show was like, she was all into like, no, we must be more bellicose, we must attack. Here she was like, no, we got to defuse the situation.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an interesting flip.
Yeah.
You know? And the way she defuses the situation is just awesome. She knows there's somebody on the other ship she could talk to. Who does she talk to?
She talks to Spock, her semi-brother.
She sends him a private message. Mm-hmm. She texts him, basically. And she and Spock are able to like get everybody to take a beat. And then they look for alternate. They kind of all stall for time, basically. And the stuff between her and Spock is really, not to use a Vulcan phrase, is pretty fascinating. Because, you know, when you're writing for these new characters, you know, it's a little it's one thing. But like when Spock comes in, it's like, especially now that Leonard Nimoy is dead, it's like, oh my God, it's like the most important guy in all of fiction is here. You know,
yeah, who's he's already important? Like got a very big reputation. Even like if you don't really know Star Trek, for example, like me, you still know Spock.
Yeah. And David Mack gets his humor well. Like Spock is, even though Spock is allegedly not emotional, he's a funny dude, you know. And so he and Burnham go off on this quest, basically. Mm-hmm. And they don't really like each other. They have a little bit of a sibling rivalry. Although it's not like they really were not brother and sister, like because they were
Didn't
educated
seem like it,
differently.
Yeah.
But the thing that bugged Spock, as you'll learn, is that it just always kind of shocked him that there was someone else out there that had a parental relationship with his parents.
Yeah.
So and Burnham and Sarek's relationship is way screwed up, you know.
Yeah.
But there's a lot going on there. So it's pretty neat. And the other thing about that particularly that I liked was about the Spock stuff was it's kind of, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but they have like when they have their big climactic thing, they have a mind meld.
That's true.
Basically.
How far are we allowed to get into like spoiler territory?
Since September.
Okay, so, fair. Yeah.
I mean, I think we're gonna have to put a spoiler warning.
Yeah, we'll put a spoiler warning.
All right, we'll keep it. We'll have like
they have their big mind meld. They kind of have to, like, in order to save the day, they must mind meld.
It's one of the Saw traps.
Yes, and neither of them want to mind meld for like they're all shy. I mean, I wouldn't want to mind meld.
You know what though? I felt that I understand the place in the story that took, but Burnham's reluctance like bothered me, like really bothered me. That it's
really?
Like, I won't do this, but I'm gonna literally all these people die because I don't want to share my brain. Like I understand.
True, I guess.
Like it seems like a little too.
Like where does it mesh with how we know her character?
It's like,
so far.
Hey, we need a conflict here, so let's put this here, even though it doesn't quite make sense.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, because you're right. Giorgio will die. All of her pals will
Everybody
die.
Everybody would die.
But mind melds. Like, you want me to mind meld with you? Well, I'm gonna know every time you farted in class. You know, it's gonna be rough.
Yeah,
you know?
but hundreds of thousands of lives are not on the line.
That's true. You're a good man, Brian. I like that. it's tough, you know, but then they explain, you know, why it's so meaningful to her. There's all this psychological damage. Her parents were killed in a terrorist attack and stuff with the mother and blah, blah, blah.
And then her previous mind meld as well, which was something we learned about in the show.
Yes. So.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, no, I don't remember some of the details they mentioned in the book happening from the perspective we got on the show.
Like I think they shaved it to its essence in the show.
Yeah.
I think you get a little bit more You get the dots filled in here. So you learn more about how the parents died and why, and Burnham feels responsible and all that. And
is resurrection via mind meld something that has occurred in Star Trek before?
No. Okay. What has happened was there was something where Spock dumped his Katra, or his essence, into the vessel known as of Dr. McCoy at the end of Star Trek II, and then an ancient ritual was able to bring it back to his body, which had been reformed on the Genesis planet. Don't look at me like that. So the Genesis planet took Spock's dead body, and because it was in a rejuvenative state, it revivified the body somehow. Okay. But it was an empty vessel.
Right. It wasn't.
Spock had dumped his Katra into Dr. McCoy. Mm-hmm. And then Star Trek III, the whole point is getting Dr. McCoy's brain, Spock's body, back to Vulcan. Yeah. And then the ancient priestess did the ancient ritual known as Fal Tor Pan.
Okay.
Which had only been talked about in lore and legend. Uh-huh. But they were able to bring Spock back from the dead.
All right, cool.
That and a really good deal memo from Paramount was able to get Spock back from the dead.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's how that went down. But no, the
so not exactly. Basically.
No, what they talk, I mean, it's hinted at in the show, but what's explored more in this book is the terrorist attack. Now, I think there were two terrorist attacks, right? There was one that killed Burnham's parents at their home.
Yes, correct.
And then there was one at the school.
Yes.
And
that's when the mind meld happened.
Yeah. And the reasons for those are still a little vague. It was like Klingon baddies were just
That's about as much, I think, as we get.
Maybe later we'll discover that there's some political stuff in there we don't know about. But
I'm sure there's something in the back half of the season.
Yeah. So at the second one, Burnham was, you know, flatlined for X amount of minutes.
3 minutes, I think.
But
said, yeah.
The Sarek was able to do a such a powerful meld that brought her back.
Mm-hmm.
Not at his own. He wasn't going to do it, but Amanda
made
him do it because Amanda felt.
Which also kind of angered Spock a little bit in a way.
Yeah.
Right. Because
I mean, like everything.
Yeah, he was like, wow, Mom never did anything like that for me, you know? She made me pack a lunch, and here here she is telling her to bring this person back to life. So it's heavy stuff, you know? But in those mind meld scenes, and the writing in that section is clever because they switch personas.
Yeah, and it puts them into the other person's memory, but still as themselves.
Yeah, it's pretty freaky. So then there's, you get to see in brief sort of snapshots Burnham's childhood and adolescence and Spock's childhood and adolescence. And all I'll say, and this is what I was referring to earlier, there is an incident that Burnham witnesses through the eyes of Spock, which is from Deep Cut Star Trek, an incident from the animated series.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which is, people who know what I'm talking about. But if you don't know, there's a very, kind of the saddest moment in Spock's life is revisited. So you get to see Aichaya again, if you know what I'm. It's a little.
I did get like drifts of like the Futurama pizza dog episode while reading that. I was like, no.
yep. So that's the cool. And by the way, I have just a couple of scatter notes. The one other really cool thing that I loved about reading this is like a couple things that is answered questions.
Mm-hmm.
So like Philippa Georgiou, like Georgiou is a Greek last name.
Right.
Michelle Yao does not look particularly Greek, but she makes a reference to her
ex-husband.
Ex-husband Nikos. I'm like, there you go. Finally. All these months later, ex-husband Nikos. Check, somebody explain that. Because they've never mentioned her ex-husband before on the show, have they?
No, I don't think so. No. I just accepted it. I was like, okay, sure.
Yeah,
why
she's
not?
Got. I mean, that's the thing. It was like, her name is Michael, for God's sakes.
Although I did find it funny that at so many points throughout, at least the beginning of the book, they go like, this person is British, or this person it looks kind of Polynesian, or like, this person is Indian, where they made such a point out of clarifying everyone's backgrounds, where I was like, I get it. I get it.
That's Star Trek novels. They all do that. That is something that that you'll get a lot of in the Starfleet Corps of Engineer books.
Okay.
There's a lot of
the country of origin.
You know, yeah, there's a lot of country of origin, you know, whose parents hailed from Sri Lanka but was raised in Canada. Okay. You know, there's a lot of point of origin stuff for better or for worse. Yeah. I mean, I guess probably for the best.
Yeah, it's nice.
Inclusive, but. Yeah, there was one. It was like her Polynesian heritage.
That one was weird because the way that they phrased it was Polynesian looking. And I was like, what?
It's The Rock. Maybe it was for The Rock. I don't know. Okay. Who knows?
But Tarantino Star Trek starring The Rock.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, absolutely.
Genius.
Yes.
So I think that that Giorgio moment really was a big win. And then the other one, and this is a hardcore. This is at the end of the book. I'm going to just come right out and say it. The last 10 pages is after the adventure, Spock goes through a lot. First of all, they save a planet.
Yep.
But he personally goes through a lot because of the meld. Mm-hmm. He understands his parents a little better. He has a new relationship with Burnham. And he also, most importantly, has a new relationship with himself. And Una, number one, is like, they're in the mess hall. And he's trying to eat his plomeek soup. And he's like staring at his soup, not really eating. And Una's like, you seem different. You seem quiet. You seem reserved. And then the interior monologue is like, I do feel different. I do see things differently. That is, I mean, it works in the novel and it works in the story, but that's also kind of a hat tip to fans who, when they watch The Cage, as a joke, Spock in The Cage, because it was shot in 1964, before they came back to do the series, Spock from The Cage acts a lot differently from the real Spock.
Okay.
He yells, and he gets emotional, and there's a famous shot of him, like, they're all on the transporter deck, and they're about to beam, but then only Una and I forget the yeoman's name, the little redheaded yeoman, the two women disappear. And then they're like, everybody freezes, and Spock, Leonard Nimoy, just goes, the women! Like, it's like a really weird moment. It's kind of like a really awkward line reading. So that, I feel, was David Mack saying, I have an opportunity here
to
explain that, yes, that there was a moment of evolution in Spock's behavior between The Cage and when we next saw him on TV in 1966 and The Man Trap, or when they shot Where No Man Has Gone Before, etc. So that, I thought, was a really smart move on their part.
I didn't catch any of those. I only caught like one other Star Trek thing, I think, which was like a catchphrase thing. But anyway, I don't know how.
Yeah, there was a moment when Georgiou is like having a bad day. And she thinks herself, angels and ministers of grace defend us, which is a line from, it's a line from Hamlet, but it's a line from Star Trek IV. Bones says that when he's like, instead of going like, oi, you know, he says that line. And Giorgio says it. So that was a pretty smart wink in there also.
I was thinking of when the dentist, like towards the end of the book, he's like, I'm not a doctor, damn it. Like, I'm a dentist.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, I didn't even catch that one.
I think this is...
I thought that was a very like weird little thing to put 100%. In the...
Oh, 100%. Love the dentist. Yeah.
No, such a weird buildup to it. Yeah, like, that's what...
like, it was such a weird little like added detail into the book that it...
It kind of doesn't go anywhere. Like, they make a big stink at the beginning.
Yeah.
The other thing is, like, all these characters, like, you know you're never going to see them again.
Yeah.
So it's like, kind of, it's like, make them fun or who cares? Which I think they did a good job. Like,
they did, yes.
The dentist is a great example. I forget the character's name.
Spyropoulos or something like that.
Awesome. Yeah, something like that.
They want to have an away mission, and they need to bring medical team. And the dentist is like, I never go on an away mission.
Yeah.
And he's like, because you're a dentist. What do they need with you? And he's like, if I don't get enough.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he wanted his SAG card or something. He's like, if I don't get enough of these.
Then I won't get promoted.
Missions, I won't get promoted. Yeah. I'm a junior grade, blah, blah, blah. He's like, all right, you can come and just keep your mouth shut. And then, of course, they get down to the planet.
And they get captured.
Yeah, they get captured. And so the dentist is trapped there. So that was pretty... And yeah, that's a character that'll never appear again.
I know. But I never thought about Starfleet dentists. Like, what is their healthcare plan? But now I have a little bit
of insight. You know, it's funny. I think this is probably the only dentist I've seen in... There definitely is a barber.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen Starfleet barbers. Mott, he's a Bolian. But I've never... come across a dentist before, so that might
be
the
good
first.
For this guy.
Yeah, Spyropoulos. there were a couple of other little nods to those sort of things. They talked a little bit about there was some shading about World War III.
That was insane to read, I have to say.
Yeah, because they, you know, World War III is danced around a lot in Star Trek mm-hmm. lore, you know, intentionally. But there's a line, they're figuring out how to, they have to quell, like, the populace of this of yeah. this planet in the middle of, like, 20 other tasks. So it's remote controlled, Gant said. The command system would be crippled by the same scrambling field that's blocking our transporters. And as I'm sure you recall, autonomous robotic attack systems, and then Saru interrupts, are prohibited by Federation law. He said, finishing the citation, a most nettlesome restriction, if you ask me. Ensign Fan turned away from the communications console. That's what the people of Earth used to think, right up until World War III. Every time I think of those killer bots in the streets of Paris, I get a shiver down my spine. And that's it. That's all you get.
As soon as I was like, are we talking about drone warfare?
Yeah, like, what
right
is
now?
Going on there? Like, I need to know more about that immediately. but that's all you get. And, yeah. You know, and this is just, you know, a nice little thing that's hidden in there. Mm-hmm. And there are other similar things, particularly the Saru stuff. So about his background. And
I want to see, like, a bunch of Kelpians at once. I feel like it'd be very unsettling.
Yeah. Well, the good news is this. The next book that has been announced, that's the second to next one. The one that's coming out in February is written by Dayton Ward, who's also been a guest on the show. And it is set, I think, a year before Desperate Hours.
Okay.
It's set on Talos IV, mm-hmm. which is the planet from the incident in the cage. I think that's what it is. I could have gotten my facts wrong, but it's not set during the cage. It's set before the cage.
I just remember that you texted me.
Well,
just
this
like
is the third one. Hold on.
Okay.
So the one that's coming out next from Dayton Ward is, I believe what it is going to be is, like, if you go to the cage, if you watch the cage, when they get there, there is the hologram of the ship that crashed there.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess is that the book will be the true story of what happened. Okay? All right, that sounds pretty cool.
That's
I'm down.
That's pretty cool that it, like, all ties back to the other stuff.
And then the third one, which will be coming out in summer, is, I think it's just called Saru.
Oh, my God.
Saru origin stories or whatever. So they're doing a Saru book next summer, and it's James Swallow is writing. He is, I believe, British.
Mm-hmm.
James Swallow, I've read, he did, and, oh, you know, if I had my computer, like I said, we're not at the usual studio right now. I believe James Swallow wrote one of the Deep Space Nine prequel novels called the Terok Nor trilogy, if I'm not mistaken. So that's going to be dynamite. So you're going to get all your Kelpian
very excited
goodness through that. And then eventually there'll be Saru comics. They can't not have Saru comics. I mean, it's just too good. So was that your favorite? That was your favorite section was...
I loved all the Saru stuff. Yeah. I also liked getting to spend more time with Georgiou just because I love Michelle Yeoh. And when it was announced that she was going to be in the show, I was so excited. And then she died so quickly.
Right.
So getting more of her and also just more of an idea of her as a captain was pretty
cool. Yeah, and you know what? I didn't really realize it until reading this book.
Yeah.
Because she was only in two episodes.
Yeah.
She had made a pretty resonant mark. Like, I could hear her voice.
Yeah.
In this, and she's very funny.
Yeah,
you know, she has a playful side. She has kind of like an anarchic side. She likes not doing what people tell her to do. Right?
She likes doing the right thing, which is not necessarily the ordered thing.
Yeah, and I could definitely hear that character, the Michelle Yeoh's character in it, and she's tough. You know,
she's so charismatic. Like, it's hard not to immediately just see her, even in text.
Yeah. And I love that her office doors can frost over.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Brian, did you have a favorite section?
You know, when you asked Karen that, I was thinking if I had one. And I'm not sure. I really enjoyed the entire book. I mean, I hated the miners. I love the Spock and I love the Spock and Burnham stuff. I love Saru and Una. I love Pike and Georgiou. I mean,
it's fun. Yeah.
Well, you know, I came away thinking, like, Pike does not come across too great in this. Like, he's got some splaining to do. Like, he did not act like a righteous man.
I feel
you know?
Like, he has a pretty big reservoir of goodwill to draw on, though.
Sure, but, like, if it was Kirk or Picard in his shoes, they would have found a way.
Right.
Like, I mean, they would not have listened to the Admiral.
I feel like this was probably earlier in his career.
Oh, for sure,
And maybe he hasn't... I don't know. I got the vibe that he was trying to prove himself.
Yeah, there are a few passages in it that were talking about, like, how he's still kind of a young officer.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, was worried about his perception a little bit, whereas Georgiou was not as much, you know?
She could not care less. Well, I mean, she could, but...
Cool. I think... So those were kind of all the notes I had on that.
There were two little minor details that I wanted to mention, too, is that these were characters that were from the pilot of Discovery that I think made appearances in this book. I don't have an image of him, but there was a guy. We talked about this in the trailer or the first episode.
Dude? Yeah. Oh, yeah,
well,
he's
no,
in there.
Well, that too. Yeah. But it was a guy that they mentioned he had cybernetic implants.
Yeah.
Oh,
I think there was a guy
yeah.
with a blue face that had some like pointy things coming out, almost like pinhead looking.
Yeah, yeah, he's in here.
I'm pretty sure that was Lieutenant Troke in this book. And
there's somebody named Januzzi.
That was a great name.
Yes. Yeah. And then this I have an image of is I remember this from the... From the pilot.
Yeah.
The VR helmet. I was very happy to have that explanation of what that was.
Yeah, but you know, VR helmet lady screwed up her job.
She definitely did.
She's not very good at her
no,
work.
She is not. But that was a detail that I remembered from the pilot that I'm like, oh, wow, that's interesting. I want to know more about that.
Yeah.
That gave it to me. So I was happy to see that.
Some of those images from the early trailer and from the first episodes, you're going to get to know more about that. And then Detmer, which is not like a joke at this point. Like, we're never going to get to know anything about her. She's just that woman.
Yeah. Well, we got
with nice eyes.
We found out more about those two characters than we did about Denver.
Denver's
still around.
Denver's the one who lived.
Yeah.
There was one little note about her where it said that she, it was implied that she was good at her. At being Helm, and she's top notch.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Yes.
Good.
As good a detail as any. Yeah.
Not much background, but I guess it's funny.
Well, you know, the show's
maybe they got more plans for later.
Five seasons from now, we're never going to know anything about her. That would be the joke.
Six seasons, she'll get like a Detmer episode.
Right. That'll be the one. It'll like open up like on Earth.
Yeah.
And it'll be like, what is this? And it'll be like
this little redhead.
Little redheaded girl. It'll be like the Detmer story. Yeah, yeah. It's like there she is, a youth, and we'll get to see the whole thing.
Slightly belatedly, am I wrong or did they mention that Michelle Yeoh was going to be coming back in some capacity? I feel like they said she would have a.
I imagine that it has to happen.
They can't get her.
They can't get such a huge actress to play such a large role and not have her come back. My guess is flashbacks or if
Force Ghost. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Maybe she's a hologram or something now. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Or there are other possibilities as well.
Okay.
Yeah, it would be great. It would be great to see her again. I like the Force Ghost idea.
It was kind of on my mind while I was reading this because the last like tie-ins that I really read were like the X-Wing novels.
Yes.
Which, I mean, I liked in the same capacity where it was like I get to find out about characters that I don't really see in the movies or the series or whatever. But anyway, it's a different bag of...
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you something. Reading franchise fiction is, I mean, sometimes it's a speed read. Sometimes it's, sometimes they're not very good.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you will find yourself reading... a really good book, and you would say to yourself, I mean, usually science fiction, but not always, and it would be like, in a way, if this wasn't branded a Halo novel
like
or
I
whatever,
still would think it
well,
was
not
good,
that,
yeah.
like more people would potentially be reading it, you know?
Right.
And I feel like there are probably authors who have ideas for sci-fi books or fantasy books, and they're not able to sell them.
Yeah.
But then they get a gig where they can do a tie-in book.
Yeah, yeah.
And they can say, oh, well, I can work in those characters. Because there are always characters that are new to each story.
Right.
Like, in this book, it's all the people on the colony. And they sort of they're not front stage, you know? So this is not the best example of what I'm talking about. But, David Mack, for example, he wrote a very important Star Trek trilogy called the Destiny Trilogy. And there is a whole planet and a culture in that only exists in the Destiny Trilogy.
Yeah.
And it's great. And because it's three books, he has a little more time to spread it out. if you took that kernel of what, and I forget the name of the planet they go to, but they're trapped in, actually. It's like a prison planet. If you pick that out of the trilogy and packaged it in another original sci-fi book,
it would be successful.
I don't know if it would be more successful, but it would work, you know?
Right.
It's a paradox of our age that it's very difficult to sell original stuff now.
It kind of sucks sometimes because there have been a couple reboots or remakes that I've seen this year where I was like, if you had just called it something else, I would have liked it way more than if you were like, this is a property thing.
Yeah, just, like a movies or television shows? Or?
I thought, this is going to get me a lot of flack,
no,
but
go
I, thought
for it.
I thought about the new Blade Runner movie where I was like, I think it's good, but I would have liked it more if you just said this is a new sci-fi movie. It's not a Blade Runner property.
I don't know if I need you to walk me through that a little bit more, because so much of the new Blade Runner is dependent on, like, the story. I mean, it really does pick up the story from before. I mean, how you would need to finagle it a little bit.
I mean, for sure. But I mean, all the stuff about the nature of, like, AI, especially the whole, like, Joy storyline, and also how Joe ends up being a, I mean, spoilers for Blade Runner, I guess.
I saw it.
Been out in theaters for a while.
But all the stuff about how he basically is a red herring, even though he's the main character,
and how everything
eventually has to tie back to the Blade Runner mythos. I was like, I would have liked it more as, like, a standalone just about him, or just about the development of artificial intelligence in this future society.
And he could still go on, like, a father quest, but it doesn't have to be Harrison Ford.
Yeah,
it can just be, like, this character. Mm-hmm. You must find him, you know? You know, you're not necessarily wrong, yeah. I mean, and there are, you know, that's just one example, but
you know, I mean, I keep hearing about there's a new Netflix series, Altered Carbon.
I saw a trailer for that, and it literally looks like Blade Runner.
Yeah. I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, no, it looks really good.
It looks like if someone had a lot of money and made a Blade Runner knockoff.
It's not out yet, right?
No, I don't believe so.
I think it's James Purefoy
and Joel Kinnaman.
Joel Kinnaman. When you can't get Jay Courtney, you get Joel Kinnaman.
That's such a low blow.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, I don't have any dog in this fight, so.
What is it called again?
Altered Carbon?
Yeah.
Altered Carbon. I'll watch that show. Oh, but it's a Netflix show.
Yeah. It is a Netflix show, yeah.
Now, I love Netflix. I pay for it. I don't like the fact that it all comes out at once.
It's really annoying.
It's stressful because, you know, it's like
you gotta watch it all, otherwise it's gonna get spoiled at the water cooler.
Oh, absolutely.
That's the thing. I like having it all accessible at once, but I don't like the culture of everyone having to.
Oh, it's totally fine if
once.
You miss the boat. Like, I still have not. This mock me if you must. I have never watched Breaking Bad.
Damn.
I know. I might as well just leave the country. I know. So, but I'm going to do it eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's my fault that I didn't do it at the time. So if I get spoiled, that's fine. I know.
I mean,
Heisenberg, whatever.
My dad only watched it in, like, the last 2 or 3 years, and he, like, still was not spoiled for it. So I think he'll be fine.
Okay. But the point is, like, and I do like the fact that when I do get to it, I'm going to chow down and go through it.
Yeah, yeah.
But when it's happening new, because Star Trek Discovery is on Netflix in Europe, and they do it week to week.
Okay.
And even though, I mean, All Access is not, All Access is its own thing.
Yeah.
The week-by-week aspect of this show, Discovery, is something I really admire.
It's nice. And some shows do better that way. Like, I was watching Vice Principals earlier this year over the last two seasons, and I was thinking, this does fine as episodically, but sometimes, like, some shows just work better as an entire whole, and other shows are kind of better if you can space it out a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I binged the heck out of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Oh, did you like it? I haven't seen it yet.
So
okay.
It's so good. But that works well as a binge because it's kind of like one long episode.
Sure.
And it's 8 episodes, so it's not that long. I think the last one is an hour, and most of them like 47 minutes or so. So we watched 2 a night.
Yeah.
So we started on Monday, ended on a Wednesday,
yeah.
You know, and that was fine. But yeah, the other binge stuff, I mean, it's not going to change. I mean, clearly the model is working for them.
Yeah.
So us griping about it. But I feel like eventually maybe it will. You know what will happen? They're going to do a test. They're going to have one property that people really, really are anticipating.
Right.
Something really big. And they're going to try it out week to week and see how it goes. Because they have the technology to do it because they do it in Europe. You know, eventually Disney/Marvel is going to have their own CBS All Access.
Yeah.
And they're going to have Star Wars on
there. They've already announced it. I mean.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't have the money for that.
Well, eventually you're going to cut cable. You're going to get rid of cable.
I don't have cable.
Well,
I still don't.
You're also going to get a job.
No, okay,
you're going to have all these things, and they're going to get rid of cable. And the Marvel Disney one, when Star Wars the show, live action, with real actors.
Oof, yeah.
Not Joel Kinnaman, but
when do
you
think that's going to happen? Within like the next 5 or 10 years?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No Joel Kinnaman. They'll get Jai Courtney for that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, like when they have like whenever when the Star Wars show is cooking, then a decision needs to be made. Do we drop it all at once, or do it week by week?
Week.
And this Star Trek is
my argument. If you look at Discovery as an example,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Think about how much we talked about Tyler Vok leading up to that.
If they
imagine,
had like that,
imagine
for Star
that
Wars.
Was all a binge. Mm-hmm. And it just happens, like there's no fun in that. It completely kills the conversation.
Yeah,
the mystery,
no, the week to week aspect.
It was fantastic.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. It feels like quote unquote kind of old school to have at this point to have the episodes week by week, but it's nice. It's like I like having something.
What are the big shows that are still week to week? Are Game of Thrones,
Walking Dead, probably.
Which everybody hates.
Yeah,
but
everybody hates it again. Yeah,
but it still gets people watching and talking.
Yeah.
And then I don't know, like how to get away with murder.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know what else is on television anymore.
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, Sunday
Scandals
nights
ending.
Is that it?
Yeah, it's not. So I predict that. I predict. Here's my bold prediction.
Okay.
If I had the soundboard today, Brian, I'd push a button. The Star Wars show may or may not be week to week. And the reason I'm mentioning that is
like,
no. This is my prediction. They're going to spend a lot of time doing A/B testing on it and thinking about it. They're not just going to say, "Oh, we should binge it," and everybody goes, "Yep, yep, yep." They're going to be like, "We got to really think this through.
We got to milk it.
We got to milk it." And I think they should do it week to week. But that's just me. Also, who cares about Star Wars? This is a Star Trek podcast.
I was going to say, we've given so much airtime.
You know where I'm going in like
fault, but...
a few hours?
Oh,
go
really?
To see Star Wars.
Oh, man. Can
the
I come?
The Last Jedi, I wish.
Humble brag.
A little bit. Me and the Porgs. I don't know too much about the new one. I watched the trailer once.
That's the same thing I did.
I
was like, I don't need
movies. I watched the trailer. The first trailer they put out is the only thing I watch, and then I go, you already have my money. Why do I need to see more?
Yeah. There was one battle. It looks like it's on snow, and there's like red
That looked pretty cool.
Why
it reminded me of like the Godzilla, the Godzilla movie that came out. Yeah, like
I like the new
years
Godzilla.
Ago. It ruled. It was great.
Why would there be red smoke?
Because
are
cool.
they
sand?
Red Squadron?
Red sand?
Not Red Squadron.
Maybe it's a diversion tactic. Who knows?
Who's the guy in these new movies? Who's the bad guy? Not
Kylo Ren.
No, the other one.
Snoke.
No, the other one. The
shit. Oh, sorry. Can we cuss?
Yes, you can.
Okay,
cuss.
I'm sorry.
There's cussing in the book too. By the way, they say the S word. No, it's
Burnham says it.
Yeah, that's true. She does.
What is the name? He's the Domhnall Gleeson. What is his character's name?
Oh, God.
Ambassador.
Oh no.
Right, Domhnall Gleeson is
right.
in this movie. He's the head of the First Order.
Donald Gleeson. Oh, God damn it.
I'm
not going to remember.
Yeah, you know what? The new Star Wars movies?
Hold on, I'm looking it up.
I agree.
They kind of go in one ear and out the other for
100%,
me. They don't stick
them.
To your ribs.
Although, like, I'm the weirdo who was like, I love the prequels, so I'm not
Yeah,
a
no,
good
that's
person.
Unacceptable. And your relationship with The Cure for Wellness needs to be addressed at some point
it's
also.
It's so good.
It's an okay
so
movie.
Good.
It's an
Jordan.
It's okay.
Uh-uh. It's going on my top 10 of the
that's
year.
That's fine. Did you see the one...
Valerian?
Oh,
okay.
No, do you get the name, Domhnall Gleeson's name?
I almost have it. Sorry. I was interrupting about...
yeah, come on. Stay on task.
I have to Google something.
The actor from those two movies you just mentioned, I'm not a huge fan.
Domhnall Gleeson?
No. Domhnall Gleeson's good. General Hux.
General Hux. That's right. Yeah. Right.
Jai Courtney? Who?
No. Dane DeHaan?
Yeah.
I don't usually like him that much either, but I loved A Cure for Wellness so much that like everything about it.
Wasn't that the movie that was supposed to be? It was Gore Verbinski, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, it was.
I feel like that was made out of the death of his BioShock movie.
It kind of was. He like reused like some of the sets or something for it. It's
the problem with Cure for Wellness is
so off track.
It lacks a little. It just doesn't snap together. It's a
I
lot
have to
of
watch
great.
It now.
It's so good.
A lot of great
don't,
component parts.
I didn't hate Valerian, but I did not like him at all.
Valerian. But he's terrible in Valerian.
I've
but
heard
it,
he's
Valerian,
very miscast.
Valerian
I still haven't
is good enough to. So
and you're saying it's better than A Cure for Wellness?
100%.
Oh my god.
But I'm going to give you something. I am going to be obnoxious film bro for a minute.
Sure.
Because you love Cure for Wellness, and you love Shape of Water also, right?
I love Shape of Water.
Okay. Did you see Evolution from like 2 years ago? This is such an obnoxious film bro moment. You should just throw your Poland spring up more. There is I believe she's Serbian or, you know, from somewhere. There's a filmmaker by the name of, I can't pronounce her name because it is, Lucille had... She's Gaspar Noé's wife, but I don't want to. It's that sexist to describe someone by their spouse. So her name is Lucille Hadzil Halilovich. Can you see?
Uh-huh, I can see it.
Yeah. She made a movie in 2015 called Evolution. Uh-huh. What language is it in?
It was about falling in love with a fish man.
Kinda.
Okay.
And it is it.
It's
more like Shape of Wellness because a lot of fish
Shape
stuff.
Shape of Wellness.
It's more like the Road to Wellville. What is it called? The
Road to Wellville.
What is the wellness movie called?
Yeah, that wellness.
Cure for Wellness.
We're talking so much interspecies romance right now. I feel like that's our through line. That's where it all ties back to loving.
Cure for Wellness wishes it could be Evolution.
Wow, that's
and
a throwdown.
Evolution was a movie that played, I think, for 6 days in the United States.
So did Cure for Wellness.
That's true, but it was a big hit in France or Belgium.
Oh, okay.
Country of origin is France, Spain, and Belgium.
Uh-huh.
Critical response: Rotten Tomatoes, 80%. Wow,
okay,
what are the critics
sure.
now? It's so good.
True.
So that is my. That is my gift to you.
Thank you so much.
Is for you to watch that movie. It's really, really good. I loved it. And
Merry Christmas.
The few people, but it's a lot like Cure for Wellness.
Okay.
They play in the same murky eel-infested pool, you know. So I think you'll dig it. I think you'll dig it. So yeah, end of the year, Karen Hunt. That your favorite movie of the year is Cure for Wellness?
It's up there. I think it's like right. The things that I've been thinking about a lot are Cure for Wellness, Shape of Water, Lost City Z, and
movie.
Wormwood, which I saw this weekend, and I'm obsessed with.
Wormwood is really good.
It's so good.
Yeah, that's another Netflix movie. Watch that in one day.
Yeah, I mean it's 4 hours, so it's pretty doable.
Yeah. Wormwood is real cool.
What else is on my top 10 this year? I'm not sure.
Which was your favorite episode of Discovery?
Hmm.
I know it kind of feels like they're all one, right? But they do. I mean, but there are.
I watch them in pretty big chunks, so I'm not sure.
I mean, there was the time loop one.
The time loop one. I like pretty like domestic stuff. So when they're all just like hanging out and partying, I like that.
The time loop one was the one.
Oh, that's another thing I had to bring up too.
Yeah?
With the parties. So in this book,
there's
a nice, fancy, elegant party.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But still, the contrast to the time loop episode is like the fist pumping
right,
party.
Right, yeah. This party is a grown up party.
Yeah.
The one in this book, yeah.
So I'm just curious of what kind of parties actually exist in the future.
I think the same range of parties that exist now.
Right, there are still adult parties. You may not get invited to them, but there are still adult parties. No, you're right. There's early on in this book, there's an adult party, and
sounds bad.
No, like they're sitting around drinking cocktails and talking.
See?
You know, they're not shouting over music.
Yeah,
you know,
they're like dressed formally.
They're dressed formally, and then Saru like goes and sulks for a while.
Love him.
Now, speaking of, and this is probably how we should wrap up, because you love Saru.
I do.
You love adult parties.
I don't know about that part.
It was, how many weeks ago did this happen?
2 weeks.
2 weeks ago, Karen and I, and other, a lot of alumni of this podcast were there. There was a little shindig. Emma was there.
Yep.
Emma was on last week. Maybe Matt Singer was there. He tends to, I don't know.
I don't remember.
X amount of people that have been guests on this podcast were there. It was a party for end of the year for one of the movie studios, and one of the movies that they were promoting was in fact Shape of Water,
yes,
which stars Richard Jenkins, who was in attendance,
yes,
and was
Guillermo del Toro was there.
Guillermo del Toro, was Sally Hawkins there? I didn't see
her. No, it was just the three guys,
and the third one was Doug Jones, who was very tall.
He's the sweetest man alive.
He was wearing a maroon sweater.
I would say red. Very festive red sweater.
Festive, like I say, he was wearing a festive red sweater. And he was, you know, he's not a star. He's not a celeb. He can walk down the street and nobody's going to know him. But at this party, he was like the king of the room. And everybody wanted to come and, yeah, some people wanted to bug him and get a selfie with him. But some people just wanted to say, you're the best and we love you.
Mm-hmm.
So I was with Karen and Emma mostly, and Emma was like quaking, like Saru herself, and Emma also was very tall, so her Saru qualities are really in effect. And she was like, I want to talk to him, and I went over and spoke to him. I was like, hey, Doug, how you doing? Blah, 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 blah. And then later she was like, I don't want to talk to him, I don't know what to do. And you were there,
yep.
And you were a little bit of hemming and hawing. You wanted to talk to him, but you...
That's the same whenever I see anybody that I want to talk to, that it'll take me a while to work up the courage to go talk to anybody.
Right, it's like diving into a cold swimming pool. You know, so
like
so...
talking to your crush at the high school dance.
All right, fair enough. So I, and also Doug Jones was being cornered by these two knuckleheads who I won't mention. I'm like, oh, Doug needs rescuing anyway.
I remember that you literally said that.
Yeah.
We were like, we have to rescue Doug Jones.
So I go over and I go, hey, Doug, this gal here is your biggest fan, and so is she. And this was Emma and Karen, and there's a few other people were there also.
I think a gaggle of like six girls.
Yeah. I introduced Doug Jones to six young women at a party. Yeah. And then,
maybe but that's not the right time for this.
No,
I was going to say this doesn't sound.
It was all very pleasant, and you know, he also was kind of a shy guy. I mean, he's been in a million movies, but he's always under a ton of makeup, or so you know. And then I forgot. It was like, oh, I know, I love. And, you know, he's in Shape of Water. He plays the fish man. And we're like, oh, I love the fish man, and I love Saru. And then he's like, oh, Saru's my favorite. And the next thing you know, Doug was hugging everybody. It was a hug fest. It was Hug Fest 99.
He's the sweetest man.
He was hugging Karen. He was hugging Emma. He was hugging whoever else. Somebody's handing around drinks. He was hugging that guy too. It was a lot of hugs. So that was a nice moment, right? Mm-hmm. Did you get a selfie with him?
There's a picture of him with about like six of us, where he's like crouching down to be the same height.
He's very tall. He's very tall.
Yeah.
All right. So that was I did not at that point I kind of walked away. I'm like, my work is done here. I needed to accomplish two things. I needed to get Doug Jones away from the two Schmendricks that were bothering him.
So were like Giorgio in the party.
But I helped out.
He was saving people from Saru.
Right. And I said, Saru, meet these nice people who like you a lot and just want a hug. So on that festive moment, I think it's basically time to roll out of here. Any final thoughts, Brian, on this episode?
No, I just really enjoyed this book a lot more than I expected to. And
was this your first Star Trek
book?
This
is my first Star Trek novel, yeah.
All right.
So I was thrilled.
Good. And Karen, any last words from you?
Also, my first Star Trek novel, although I think that's less surprising than it would be for Brian.
Right.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you guys so much for having me on. Had a really good time.
It was a pleasure to have you on. And if people want to continue interacting with you via the internet, they can reach you on Twitter at...
Mm-hmm. Karen Y. Han. KarenYhan.
What does the Y stand for?
Well, my legal first name is Youngin. It's my Korean name. And Karen's my legal middle name. But I just go by Karen. So.
How is Youngin spelled?
Like the just YOUNG-IN.
Awesome.
Which gets me a lot of like you youngin.
You youngin.
Yeah, I get a lot of that.
Out west, you know, I would like that. Okay. Karen Wyhan is on Twitter, and you can read her work at The Daily Beast and Vice and Vulture and everywhere else. So thanks again. And next week we're going to have a new episode, and then we're taking a little programming note, Brian. The big move has happened. We're down here. You know, changes. Like the Yes song says, we're going through some changes. We're going to take a little hiatus. The show's not going away. We're just taking a little hiatus, part of which is due to a great irony in that I am going to be on the Star Trek cruise. Now, one would think that there would be no finer place to podcast from than the Star Trek cruise.
That actually would be amazing.
But the Star Trek cruise is on the high seas. And I do not have access.
There's no internet on the high seas.
There's no internet. There's not really. There is, but it's very expensive.
On
it's
the
not
high
in
seas,
our budget.
No one can hear you scream.
So I will be recording, probably. We'll see. But like last year, I brought back some material. I will be recording, but we will be taking a hiatus. And then the Sundance Film Festival is right after the cruise. So
I'm gone
pretty much the entire month of January. So you won't be hearing new podcast.
Until the show's back.
Actually, that's where it gets a little weird. The show will already be on the air for a few weeks.
Yeah, the show starts the same week as the cruise, I believe.
Yeah, I know. It's not ideal. So I ask the listeners to accept the mystery of life, and we'll be back, but we're taking a little hiatus. But we've got one more show next week, and it's going to be a doozy. So until then, thank you for listening, and live long and prosper.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.